Aubrey Masango Show on 702.
Let's walk the talk. Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
17 minutes after 10 o'clock, my guest is Muzan Al-Neel. She is co-founder of the Innovation Science and Technology Think Tank for People-Centered Development in Sudan. Muzan, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
We are hearing that there was a coup, in Sudan. Tell me, corroborate that. Tell me whether that is the case or not. And please understand my question. Sometimes we hear things. We listen to news. And then we hear that a certain event has taken place. And then we discover later on that there is a particular agenda behind the reportage. Things aren't as the way that they've been reported. Corroborate that. Has there been a coup in Sudan, and what are the circumstances that have created that reality right now?
Well, if you remember, we had from the end of 2018 and the beginning of 2019, the December Revolution took place in Sudan, and it was the revolution that brought down a 30-year dictatorship, after which we had a transitional government that is basically a partnership between the military and the civilian leadership of an alliance of political parties. Over a period of 2 years, we saw that the partnership is falling apart, and realistically, we saw that what was promised by the civilian part of the government, which is that through this partnership they'll be able to bring the military leaders to justice after all the massacres that they committed against protesters, and even before that, over 30 years of a dictatorship, that did not happen. And a coup was expected due to a lot of tensions taking place between the civilian and the military side, and because the military, as expected, eventually wanted to have full power. The coup was expected to the extent that in the beginning of October, so the coup took place on October 25th, and in the beginning of October, there were already protests by resistance committees, that's neighborhood resistance committees, which is a grassroots structure that was developed over the past 3 years in Sudan. So those resistance committees took to the streets even before the coup, because we could expect it, and started to march against the upcoming coup. That was to the extent that some unions and labor groups announced that they will be a strike whenever the military marches are heard on radios. And that's why at the morning of the coup, which was the 25th of October, that's when the coup actually took place, large numbers, thousands of Sudanese people were in the streets in reject of the coup. Several strikes took place immediately, starting with a banker's strike that brought down the banking system. And the protests continue up until now, which is more than 2 months by now, actually.
Let's talk a little bit about the 30-year dictatorship you referred to before we went into the partnership, which now seems to be failing. Talk to us about Al-Bashir, Omar Al-Bashir, President Omar Al-Bashir, and how he rose to power. How did he become president of Sudan all those years ago? And what propped him up? How did he stay in power for a good 30 years?
Well, Omar al-Bashir also came to power through a coup, which took place in 1989. And that was also a coup that came after another transitional period. We keep saying in Sudan that we have a vicious cycle of military rule, followed by a revolution, followed by a transitional government, followed by another coup. And that we, again, also revolt against. And the Bashir's regime stayed for 30 years, using oppression, basically, and mostly also by starting wars in different parts of the country. The war in the south was the longest of them. This is a war that started even before Omar al-Bashir and before his regime, and it was the longest and the longest civil war in the continent. By the time that war was over, we started hearing and we started seeing the genocide in Darfur. So basically, the way that Bashir ruled is that whenever there was a part of the country that is starting to ask for or demand better living situation or better standards or even just to stop some serious injustices, they will provide weapons to militias or send in the area or send the army against them and start a war. This was a regime that was willing to start a war against its people in any place, and to keep basically their rule that was their first priority. This regime fell in 2018 at the time, and that was not the first uprising against this regime. Even just in the 10 years before it, we had another one in 2013 and in 2016. And most of those uprisings were actually coming due to the economic situation that kept deteriorating. In 2018, the economic situation got to its worst point in the 30 years. And what started the uprising against Omar al-Bashir was actually a protest by high school students who went out of their school, went to the streets, basically in protest to the increase of bread prices. Bread prices has doubled from £1. A piece of bread started to cost £2, and the students could no longer afford breakfast. There was a total anger in the country that that this protest found a lot of support in, and the protest did not stop after that in many other cities, not just the main city where it started, the city of Atbara, and it kept going up until April of 2019 when Bashir was overthrown.
Well, we're told, and I suppose by supporters of former President Omar Bashir, that in fact he came into power in 1989, and I believe he was himself a colonel, right? And he led a bloodless military coup. And part of the reason why he was able to sustain a 30-year regime is because he brought in the religious aspect, did away with political parties or a multiplicity of political parties. The country became a one-party state under Sharia law. To what extent did the religious aspect, the religious aspect of the running of the country bring about a certain level of, I don't know, of continuity? And I don't want to call it peace, because we know that there's been all sorts of things that have taken place there. I'm thinking about the Janjaweed tigers and all of those kinds of things, and you'll tell us a little bit more. But to what extent has the religious aspect, the religious process, Sharia law, been responsible for what we could, in very, very big inverted commas, call a stable-ish government for 30 years?
Well, let's start by the fact that it was not really a bloodless coup. While there wasn't, as far as we were told, there weren't killings in the streets. However, union leaders were rounded up and killed in detention, and not just in the first years of the coup, but even way afterwards. And the Bashir regime was known for what we call ghost houses. And those are basically unofficial torture houses that were used by the regime against activists, labor leaders, student activists, and so on. So it was in no way bloodless, even if we do not take into account the huge number of wars, civil wars, and internal displacement of people that took place over that past 30 years. The religious propaganda, of course, played a role, but in reality, what helped Bashir to stay was the ability of his regime to change its skin whenever needed. By the end of the 30 years, he no longer kept even the narrative of the religious propaganda that he used to get the crowds around him. And the narrative that was used has changed over the years whenever whoever his new allies were. So in the early 2000s, it was all about unity, because at that time he got some support from the Americans, and they started working with him on a comprehensive peace agreement. And then he was the man of unity and uniting the country. And after the independence of South Sudan in 2011, we started again. He went back again to the religious propaganda to sustain his regime, given that the economic situation started to deteriorate. And there were times in the middle of that where it was where he used the patriotic narrative, basically that he is being criminalized and fought by the West because they hate the Sudanese people and so on. And sometimes even stuff such as the ICC case against him, the International Criminal Court against him, was used as part of his propaganda and even helped in catalyzing the crowds against him. So it was a regime that didn't really stick to any narrative. Whenever it fell and was no longer useful, it dropped it. And that happened by the end of, very clearly by the end of his ruling. So in the in one of his last speeches, what he was trying to bribe the protesters by is that, okay, now we're going to remove all the religious laws and you can live freely. So now you can go back to your homes and no need to protest. He could not understand at that time that people were protesting for serious economic issues and it was not going to be, they were not going to go back to their houses because he now gives them nightclubs, you know? Mm. So he was willing to change his skin whenever needed. But there was also a simplified version provided by both sides, by him being telling that he is the leader of the people and so on, and also by Western propaganda and media machines that kept providing this very simple narrative of him being an extreme Islamic and people are rejecting him only because of that. While the question was always an economical one and people, first of all, just wanted to live a good life and find food and shelter.
He came to South Africa, I think in 2019, of course there was a he was a wanted man. I'm trying to find the words. I'm having a brain. He was
2017 or 16.
Yeah, earlier. Yeah. He was here in South Africa, and that court order, court order was then activated, and our government allowed him to run away. What was the narrative that you heard from a Sudanese sort of point of view about that moment? I'm linking it because, you know, that was the one time that we had a very proximal, a close encounter with Omar al-Bashir here in South Africa. But what did you hear on that side of the world?
Well, by that time, he had already lost almost all of his popularity. And whatever kind of propaganda that his people or pro-government media could put out was not even heard by the people. I remember what I saw the most, he called himself the Lion of Africa. And what I saw the most during that time was internet memes of lions running away. And people just made fun of that the lion had to escape eventually. So at that time, the public basically did not take him seriously anymore. He was just a joke to them. And unfortunately, he was a joke who killed a lot of people.
We had a bit of a joke of a government at the time ourselves. But what were the South African, the Sudanese people saying about South Africa's refusal to enforce a international court order?
Actually, what the Sudanese people focused on mostly is the fact that he escaped. So the story that reached Sudan is that he did not leave South Africa officially, but he left in a private airplane and had to go through some other airports in the middle and then come back to Sudan. At that time, Sudan has been to a far extent closed from the rest of the world for a very long time. And even the concept of international solidarity or expecting support from the outside was not there. This is very unfortunate for that time, but this is very different right now. And you'll see that in the way that Sudanese protesters right now are reaching out to the people, whether in the continent or even outside.
Another tragic story that we heard coming out of Sudan in those 30 years of the reign of Omar al-Bashir was the racial tensions between African or black Sudanese versus the Arabic Sudanese. Tell us about that dynamic. And ultimately, we saw the birth of South Sudan as a country. Just give us a sense of what was that all about, the Darfur killings, the Janjaweed tigers. Give us a sense of what was that all about, and perhaps what are the race relations at the moment looking like in Sudan?
Well, if we look at the case of Darfur, the issue in Darfur had always been an issue of land tenure in reality. It had been an issue of farmers and pastoralists and the tension between farmers and pastoralists with regards to managing these resources and managing the land. Now, as I told you, the way that Bashir's regime dealt with every issue is to find a side to give weapons to and create militias instead of actually dealing with the economic issues that people are concerned about and that are actually impacting people. This is how the tension was racialized by Bashir's regime, giving weapons to what they call the Arab tribes within Darfur. While in reality, the tension was always about farmers who wanted to protect their lands and pastoralists who wanted to have land where their animals can basically live and yep. feed themselves and so on. But they never wanted to address this issue because this is an issue that will bring in the questions of land ownership, vast amounts of land that is all owned by sectarian leaders who are part or loyal to Bashir in one way or another. So they created those wars and even racialized it to create this kind of tension. You will see right now, yesterday we lost, since the coup, we lost more than 70 protesters who were killed by the state forces. Yesterday, one of the martyrs who were killed by the state forces is actually South Sudanese. And if you check the Sudanese social media, you'll see that people are celebrating his life. People are in pain for his death. It's clear that the racial issue is not the subject. People understand that this is a person who's on their side. He's one of the poor. And on the other side, whether this government is share the same nationality with them and the martyr who was killed does not share the same nationality. This is not how people make the difference between the two sides. And they understand that John, who died yesterday, is on their side, even if they don't share the same nationality. So that's why I say it was a racialized tension, but in reality, it was always an economic struggle.
Then, of course, the whole Darfur, the war in Darfur became a big, big story circa 2003 around about 2005. We're hearing about all of those atrocities that were taking place. Has there been a revisitation of that story, some sort of a truth and reconciliation process that has been put in place in Sudan to deal with the displacements, the hurts, let me say, of that particular time?
Well, what we had around a year and a few months ago is the Juba Peace Agreement. And this was a peace agreement that was signed between the transitional government and armed rebel groups from Darfur. But again, it was one that did not address the main issues of the people. It was one that basically just gave the leaders of those movements seats in the government as ministers or governors of certain states, while the real issues of the people were never addressed. And we saw that actually in the fact that some of the hugest protests against the transitional government's policy in ignoring the economic demands of the people came from the camps of the internally displaced people. Even after the Juba Peace Agreement and even after leaders of the rebel group were ministers and governors. So it was clear that the transitional government, just like Bashir's government, just like many other governments before that we had in Sudan, decided that it's cheaper and easier just to buy off leaders than to actually answer the demands of the people.
So essentially, it was simply just the creation of, you know, expanding the reaches of the ruling elite by just getting more and more people to be part of the of governance, as it were. It was sort of a bribe, if I could call it that.
Definitely.
All right. So we keep moving, and then what were the and I'm taking you back to what you started off with. What were the conditions that gave rise to that revolution that gave us the unseating of Omar al-Bashir? Where is he right now? And what happened? How did we get to this new dispensation?
Well, in December 2018, or let's start from the beginning of 2018. Actually, in the beginning of 2018, we had a new budget by the government that was being called the budget of hunger. That was a budget that removed all subsidies for basic goods, including subsidies for food and fuel. And it was easy to expect that by the end of this year, economic deterioration is coming. And so was the fact. By November of that year, we had an inflation that increased 60%. People were in queues for everything. You had to stand in queue to get bread that already was doubled in price. You had to stand in queue to get fuel. You even had to stand in a queue to get cash from the bank. Because the inflation level got to the level where even the banks could not cover the amounts of cash required. So as I told you, that one protest that started by high school students there was already, people were already waiting for something. The anger was already there in the streets. So once those students took to the streets and that protest burned the headquarters of the ruling party in the city of Anbara, where the protest took place, that photo of the burning headquarters of the ruling party, it went viral. People were sharing it all over. Just people, after so much oppression, it was such a relief to see that we can actually stand against them and we can actually attack them, attack the ruling party and have a win against them. And people took to the streets and never stopped again. There were weekly protests and biweekly protests, one day strikes and more than that, up until April, from December to April. And in April, the protesters started a sit-in around the army headquarters that lasted up until June 3rd. And although the army removed Omar al-Bashir in April, in the beginning of April, just a few days after the sit-in started, the people remained there and they said, we want a civilian government, 100% civilian government, and we're not leaving this place until we get a civilian government. Eventually, what the military did is the massacre of June 3rd, where more than 100 protesters were killed. Many of them, their bodies were thrown into the River Nile. Hundreds are still... they're disappeared. We are yet to find them. It was a massacre that took place in 13 cities around Sudan, where there were sit-ins around army headquarters in different cities. And this massacre was the military's attempt to end any resistance from the public for a full military rule. And after the massacre, there was an internet shutdown for over a month in the country to make sure that people cannot put the news and the photos of the massacre outside or even communicate. But nevertheless, just 27 days later, on June 30th, people took to the streets again. 7 million Sudanese people around the country took to the streets again in rejection of the military rule. Unfortunately, with regional and international support, the military was still rewarded for this massacre by half of the power. They were rewarded by being made partners in the transitional government.
By whom?
And it
by
was
whom?
The
by whom? I mean, Muzan, I'm getting the sense that at that time, after the massacres, the military had had alienated itself from the people. More than 100
Definitely.
People killed and so forth. How then does the military get to be reintroduced into the governance of the country? By whom?
It is quite perplexing, right? But in reality, it was a lot of work from African governments, from Abiy Ahmed, from the African Union, who came together as negotiators, forced the civilian side, or maybe did not force them, by some means got the civilian leadership to sit down with the military. A lot of propaganda and media from the UAE and from Saudi Arabia and the EU, who kept congratulating the people of Sudan for this new model of transition. That's what they named it, a peaceful transition by having a partnership with the killers. And even a lot of our civilian leaders spent a good amount of their time and effort in trying to convince people that somehow through a partnership with the military, we'll be able to bring the military to justice. It was ridiculous. And it remained ridiculous. And over 2 years, we saw that it cannot happen. You cannot bring somebody to justice after you give them power.
Let's take a step back. So Omar al-Bashir is arrested. Where is he now?
Omar al-Bashir is supposed to be in jail, while in reality, if you walk the streets in Sudan, there are a lot of stories about how he's not really in jail. But he had been in jail and on trial for the past 2 years. And it's very unfortunate that he's actually on trial for financial crimes. He's not on trial for any of the killings or the massacres that he did. And that is expected, because putting him on trial for the massacres will then bring in the rest of the military leaders who are now, or who have been the government or partners in the government over the past 2 years.
Then we had, I suppose, a semblance of some sort of, hybrid government with military leaders and so forth. Who became the leaders then? And I suppose it's going to bring us now to the present day issues that we're dealing with right now in Sudan. Who then becomes the leader of the Sudan, even after the massacre of the people of Sudan, the 100 people that were thrown into the Nile River and so forth? Who became the leaders? Who was the face of Sudan at that point?
Well, a transitional government was formed as a partnership between the military council, which is Omar al-Bashir's security committee. So that's basically his head of the military, head of the of national security, head of rapid support forces, which is the new name for the Janjaweed militia. And basically the heads of his different official and unofficial militias who were protecting him, they became the military council, and they became one half of the transitional government.
Okay, so now I understand why the people will say that, the story is that he's in jail, but he's probably not. Now I get it, okay?
Yeah. So the other half was also the political parties that created what was called the Forces of Freedom and Change. These were the political parties, an alliance of old parties, some of them sectarian, some are not, who had always been part of power, have been in and out of power since the independence of Sudan. And they were the lead, to some extent, the leadership of the protest that took place in 2018 and 2019. So they were the civilian side, and the other side was the military side. And together they formed the transitional government.
Clearly, the vestiges of Omar al-Bashir are still very much in that structure, as you've just explained now. To what extent, then, was the civilian movement represented, and how much power did they have in this transitional government?
Well, I wonder, actually, whether that makes a difference, because in my opinion, they had very similar interests to those of the military, and we saw that in the fact that the civilians, for example, had the majority of the Sovereign Council. The Sovereign Council is a body that was created in place of a president, and it had 11 members. Six of them are civilians, and five are military. And for 2 years, we actually did not have a parliament. We did not have any kind of a parliament over the past 2 years. And the parliament was replaced by what was called the joint meeting between the Sovereign Council and the cabinet, the ministers. Mostly all of them are civilians. So they definitely had the majority, and we did not see them actually pass any laws that goes against the military interests. So I don't think the question is whether they had power, but did they have any interest in opposing the military? And the experience tells us that they didn't.
Okay. And then we later hear of a coup that takes place. Who are the players, and yes, why does the coup take place?
Well, the main players are the military. So basically the same guys who did the deal back in 2019 with the civilians. Over the few weeks prior to the coup, they started coming out in speeches talking about how the economic situation has deteriorated. There's a need for a change. And they found a lot of support from the new, the latest members of the government who came with the Juba Agreement. So that is the rebel leaders. Now, that was not a surprise. What we need to remember is that the Juba Peace Agreement was actually, the negotiations for it were led by the military side of the government. That's one thing. And the agreement itself and the negotiations that took place were funded by the allies of the military in the Gulf. So that's the government of the United Arab Emirates, basically. So it came as no surprise that the new members of the government are allies of the military. While the military gave a lot of reasons, and even the civilians gave some reasons from their side about why the coup took place when it did, I think the clearest reason will be is because they could. At that time, they had enough alliances and to support their narrative for a coup, and also the situation in the country economically made them think that there's a chance that their coup will be successful. What they failed to take into account is the level of organizing that took place among the Sudanese protesters and among communities in general that allowed the people to be able to sustain protest for more than 2 months by now against this coup. That definitely came as a surprise to them.
No doubt all of these developments have created untenable sort of human rights conditions. People have been displaced. We've seen how people have been, migrating, going to different parts of the region and some into Europe, looking for a better life. Tell me about that reality, about the displacement of people moving to different parts of the country. What has that reality looked like in Sudan?
Well, I think that that is clearest actually in the number of people who left, who usually come from communities, agro communities, to work usually in agriculture. And Sudan is supposedly an agricultural country with vast lands and water resources and so on, who have now moved to gold mining and in very dangerous conditions. We hear every few months of news of mines collapsing and miners losing their lives. And those are basically artisanal miners. They're not going there with any safety gears. They're not going there with much knowledge. They're just there looking for, you know, the a few grams that they can sustain the lives of their extended family with. And a huge percentage of that of those who are now in mining are actually coming from agriculture communities. There are also a huge numbers of communities that have been displaced by gold companies. It's been a pattern that whenever we start hearing of conflicts in an area and people being pushed by militias to leave their historical lands, it's just a few months after that we know that this land was given to some gold mining company to start mining in it. And this was being done you know, over the past decade, and the last 2 years under the transitional government was not different at all. And this was being done through the militias of the government itself and its army. Actually, one of the strongest militias, which is the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces led by Himeti, is not known to have its main source of wealth from gold and from taking over an area called Jabal Amir by displacing the people of this area. So a lot of displacement taking place in the country for a few people to make a lot of money.
Where's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok?
I really couldn't care less, my friend.
But I mean, where is he? I mean, where is he in all
of this? We heard that he left the country. And yesterday there was news from the official news, the Sudan news agency, the official one, that he came back to give a report of his past 2 years to the current coup government. I don't know. The man has been not really.
Is your sentiment about Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok representative of how the people of Sudan generally feel about him?
I'll tell you something. So after the coup and after he was allegedly detained by the military for a month or so.
Oh, the military again.
Yeah. So he was supposed to be detained by the military for a month after the coup. People had no access to him. We didn't know what he was thinking or what's happening to him. And then while people were protesting against the military for a month at that time, he came out and signed an agreement, another agreement with the military that basically gave the military everything they asked for. A new cabinet, removal of the political parties and a totally technocratic cabinet and so on, everything they asked for. And on that day, people were already in the streets because there was already a pre-announced and scheduled protest on that day, which is November 21st. And I saw how the people switched their chants from pro-Hamdok chants to chants that named him as the coup secretary. This is what he was known as in the streets. And that clarifies that it was never about Hamdok. It was about his position and his stance that people fought for 2 years, that he is the one standing against the military. And once he clearly came out in support of the military, he was just rejected totally. His latest resignation, which took place even a month after that deal, was such a big deal for international Western media, and they had a lot of interviews about it and headlines and so on. But in Sudan, it didn't change anything. The scheduled protest went as is. The only new thing I heard was a new chant that basically in Arabic it goes "Istaqal wala mustaqal ajad wal shagal," which means whether he resigns or not, the protest schedule goes on.
So if I understand you correctly, he's become irrelevant. The people are indifferent to him because they believe he's betrayed them.
Yeah.
It sounds to me that peace and stability is still a far off aspiration for the people of Sudan, based on what I'm hearing, that the people that are holding the levers of power at the moment in Sudan are frankly estranged to the people of Sudan. Talk to me about the wealth of Sudan. Where is the wealth of Sudan? What is propping up the economy of Sudan at the moment? And talk to me about the levels of development in that sense.
Well, for decades, the Sudanese economy was forced into some sort of simplicity, where we always depended on one or two goods that are exported, and the government basically lived on the rent of exporting those goods. It was the latest is the gold. Before that, it was the oil, petrol, and before that, it was oil seeds, and before that, it was cotton. Going back all the way to the British colonization, there was always a great effort by several governments to make sure that the Sudan remains underdeveloped, that no serious industrialization or serious work into agricultural industries, although the country has all the resources necessary for that, that no serious work takes place into this kind of development in the country. And the country remained underdeveloped and dependent on one commodity since its independence in this way. And that was always very convenient for those in power. They only needed to exploit one commodity and sell it. They couldn't care what the people are doing. It does not impact them if the people are working or striking or whatever they're doing. They're not held accountable to the people because they do not need the satisfaction of the people to extract gold. They do not need the satisfaction of the people to extract oil. They do not need. So that was always the situation that the Sudanese economy was kept under. When the transitional government first came, actually Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok at the time, he said that we will no longer export raw commodities. We will manufacture things in Sudan and export commodities with added value and have an industrialized country. However, it was clear in his policies afterwards that that was not actually a serious statement, and there were no serious efforts put into that. And Sudan was kept as an exporter of one commodity. And that's the situation we are still under right now. Mm. And even the revenue of this one commodity, which is gold, basically goes to the old and the new members of the ruling class. None of it is ever coming back to the people, not in health or education or food.
Let me ask you this final question as we close. Muzan El-Neil, co-founder of the Innovation, Science and Technology Think Tank for People-Centered Development in Sudan. Can you give me a story of hope? Do you have hope? Is there a possibility that there can be a better day for the people of Sudan and the country itself?
There's definitely a lot of hope, and we find the hope in the same source that is sustaining the resistance right now, which is our resistance body, the neighborhood resistance committees that have evolved over the past 2 years, and they had to evolve because the transitional government did not create any channels of democratic participation for the people. So those resistance committees that were first created just to sustain protest against Bashir, they became the tool and the voice of the people to talk about the policies that the government are putting. And right now, they are the main bodies that are scheduling the protest, organizing the protesters, even putting out political declarations and putting out roadmaps how we want the country to be governed.
So what is the dream beyond the protests? What is the aspiration?
The aspiration is also built through the protest, because we need to remember that once, as long as it's an issue of redistributing the wealth to the people, then it has to, it will get to a change that is more than just changing the military. It's also about the way of governance. And we're seeing that now as people are electing their representatives or people are selecting the political declarations that represent them. They're also selecting the means by which they want their country to be governed.
I have to stop you. I'm so sorry. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. We've run out of time, but thank you very much for joining me and just giving us a better understanding of what Sudan is looking like at the moment. Muzan Al-Neil, co-founder of the Innovation, Science and Technology Think Tank for the People-Centered Development in Sudan. Much appreciated.